This is a recording of Gene Duffy from Calistoga, California, taped at the 6th Summer Serenity in the Sierras Convention in Oakhurst, California, on Sunday, August 25th, 1991. In observance with our 11th tradition stating anonymity at the public level, please keep this tape within the fellowship and observe the anonymity of all AA speakers.
My name is Gene, and I too am an alcoholic. And always when I identify myself as an alcoholic, I base that identification on how I interpret the definition of the word alcoholic as it's defined in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, wherein it says that we alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. And that's all it says. Doesn't make any mention to how much we drank, what we drank, where we drank, and what happened as a result of our drinking. It doesn't say, in order to be an alcoholic, got to drink wine, hang out in drunk tanks on the weekend, you know, live on Skid Row, marry the same woman four or five times, and just an honest declaration as to whether or not you have lost the ability to control your drinking. Before I go any further, I certainly would be remiss to fail to thank the committee for inviting me to wherever the hell we are, and should give thanks to the people who prepared the food. The food was delicious here this weekend, and should be very obvious to you, I love food. You know? I love food so much that I gave up sex for food. I even had a mirror put in the ceiling of my dining room. You're real bad. Sunday morning throughout AA is traditionally referred to as the spiritual meeting. I remember a long time ago the late Chuck Chamberlain was informed that I was going to be the spiritual speaker at a weekend that he was participating in, and he said having Duffy do a spiritual meeting is like having Frank Sinatra talk to nuns about group sex. But you know, all meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous are spiritual meetings. Spiritual meetings. I had some difficulty, and a lot of people had difficulty with that word spiritual in the beginning. You know, I envisioned that some form of a religious word was spiritual, and maybe in my denial, I was using that as an excuse to continue to drink, that I didn't want to get involved in any kind of religious movement. And then as I told some of you yesterday, you know, I don't have an education, and I've had to teach myself through the dictionary, and so I've looked up words, you know, for the last 25, 30 years there, so I could not only be able to pronounce some of the words, but to understand them when they were said to me. And I looked up the word spiritual once. Well, as a matter of fact, that came about because I looked up the word Christian. I was having a little trouble, you know, identifying with any particular religion or returning to a God of my understanding. I'm born and raised in Christian and Catholic, educated in parochial school systems in the East. And I have never had any problems, you know, in the belief of God. I was taught that by nuns and in the educational process and by a good Catholic mother. But my problem, like so many others, was a belief in the power of God. The power of God, and that's what I'd like to address to you here this morning. But at this particular time, when I had sort of lost faith in any kind of a religion, I began to grope for one. I wanted to be something, you know. I didn't want to, when people will say, well, what are you? I didn't want to say nothing, you know. And I didn't know, and I live up in the Napa Valley, you know, which is about 80 miles north of San Francisco, and on occasions when you're invited to share in San Francisco, it takes about an hour and a half, 2 hours to get back home at night up in the little town of Calistoga that I live in. And the routine was always the same. I'd hop in bed, you know, and sort of come down, relax a little bit, watch the late show from Channel 36 in San Jose. More to watch Carol Doda's boobs than anything else. And I'd always catch the tail end of some late show. And one night it was about the fall of the Roman Empire. And Frederick March was carrying the lead, portraying the role of Caesar, I guess. And here they were gathered in the Colosseum, and they had turned all the animals out of the Colosseum, and they were about to lift iron gates to let all of the people go into the Colosseum. And old Fred March stood up with that big club, you know, and he says, "To the arena with the Christians." Christian. That's a nice word. That's a nice sounding word. Christian, you know. I think, what the hell religion are Christians, you know? Where do Christians go to church? The only time I'd ever heard that word before was in Mutiny on the Bounty, you know. Fletcher Christian, you know. And so I got up there looking in a dictionary to see what religion Christians were. And it said, Christians, good and decent. See, spiritual. And then the word spiritual just leaped out again, you know, an AA word. And I turned the dictionary into spiritual. It says, spiritual, good and decent. See, Christians. A spiritual program is a good and decent program. A spiritual place is a good and decent place. A spiritual person. You gave Clancy more than that. Make you homesick? And that's what we gather here in this enchanting atmosphere, you know, in a spiritual nature, in an attempt to be good and decent, you know. And because spiritual has its association with the word God, that's what I want to talk to you about. God as I understand him, as I understand him. I said yesterday in my brief talk about sponsorship that there was a time when I thought sponsorship was the most important part of the program. But I've come to learn that all parts of this program carry the same degree of importance. But as it was read here this morning in that portion of the fifth chapter, the closest thing to a guarantee that this program offers, possibly the only time in our book where the answer is given, the word God is mentioned. And that's at that portion of the fifth chapter when you read the second and third of the three pertinent ideas. Now first, for those in case you are new who don't realize what I'm trying to tell you, approximately 53 years ago, and probably in a room no bigger than this, 79 people like you and I sat down and began a process of putting into writing the only thing they had to offer. And it wasn't their opinions or their theories. It was their experience, good and bad, in trying to maintain some semblance of dignity and sobriety in their lives over a period of 2 years. And they decided to put it in writing. And the book Alcoholics Anonymous was about to be born. Now in that room were the same kind of people that sit in this room this morning. Atheists, agnostics, believers, non-believers, slippers, sliders. You know, everybody in that 79 didn't stay sober. And they were just like me and you. And then perhaps one of the first miracles that was to take place in this program, of course, the first had to be the meeting of Bob and Bill. I have been told that a pact was made by these 79 people who were in constant argument over this book. You know, they all wanted their stories in the book. Some wanted pictures, some didn't want pictures, some wanted royalties, and they were no different than you and I. And you know what they agreed on? It's almost unbelievable for me to say this. They said, we will put nothing in this book unless we all agree on it. Can you imagine expecting 79 alcoholics to agree on anything? And yet it happened. Yet it happened. And as Clancy said last night, only divine guidance can account for that. And in that portion that was read here this morning, they said this. And when I say they, that is you. You said this. We believe, that's an odd word for an atheist and agnostic, we believe that no human power can relieve our alcoholism. A definite statement. And then these same people, these same non-believers, these same true believers, gave us the answer. They said, but God, and they called him God. They did not call him a rock or a tree or a bench or a stone. They said, but God could. And that is a definite statement. That is an answer to a question. God can. And then immediately the self-centered, egotistical nature of the alcoholic says, as Clancy so very well put it last night, but my case is different. Will he? And would. God could and would. So he told us the answer. And then so wisely, so divinely guided, they pushed that answer right back into your lap and allowed you to make the decision, because they said, if he were sought, God could and would if he was sought. So that leaves the choice up to you. I don't know if it's common in this area or not, but in my early training in Alcoholics Anonymous, we'd done a lot of stupid things. And one of the most stupid things we used to do when answering 12-step calls, you know, we would caution each other to, hey, soft play the God stuff. You might chase them away. Don't talk too much about God. They'll think we're some sort of a church. How wrong could we be? How wrong could we be? Soft pedal? The answer to this problem? Don't talk about the ultimate thing that we all will have to accept. And so that brought about to me a lot of confusion. And it required that I search for this God. Now that came about when I was doing a little research on my own in Chicago Skid Row. I'd been down there for about a year and a half as an animal. And some jackass from AA, a guy by the name of Ned Fink, had been pounding on my head for about 4 years, just driving me crazy. But he was always good for a quarter or a few loose cigarettes or something, so you tolerate that kind of cheap AA bullshit, you know. And he was always harping to me about God. And please, with your understanding, I'm about to use a four-letter word. And I'm not using it to prove to you that I can speak vulgarly or that I'm familiar with four-letter words. I'm sure you'll understand that I'm just trying to portray to you the epitome of that egotistical, self-centered nature of the alcoholic when we're so sick. Because I sat there in front of the Blood Bank on Broadway and Wilson, waiting for the blood bank to open up so I could sell my lousy blood for $4 to get enough wine to last till noon. I had no home, no job, nobody gave a damn who the hell I was or anything. I was at my bottom. And here's this Ned with his big books. And he's thumping me and thumping me. And he says, Duff, all you got to do is turn your life over to the care of God. And you know what my egotistical answer was? Suppose he fucks it up. How sick can you get? And I want to tell you about God as I understand him. And to some of you, I might sound blasphemous. And to some of you, I might sound sacrilegious. And to some of you, you might believe I'm trying to make mockery of some form of religion. Please, I assure you, I'm not trying to do that. I'm bound by a moral obligation to the love of this program to tell you the truth, to tell you exactly how it was with me. And that's what I'm about to do. I'm born and raised in the west side of New York City, which is not exactly Disneyland. The area that I was raised in, commonly referred to as Little Italy. And with a name like Duffy, and you live in Little Italy, you got to be fighting from the day you're born, I'll tell you that. Them little dagos were always after my ass, you know. And living in this Italian environment, I went to a parochial school, Our Lady of Victory, and Our Lady of Victory Church. And the longest half hour that you can spend in your life is when you go to parochial school and you have to go to mass before you go into school. And from 8 to 8:30, it seems like 17 hours. You know. You're 8 years old and you sit in that church, you know, playing with your baseball cards, your marbles. The nuns hit you with their stick. Up, down, kneel, sit down, bang, shut up, spit out your gum. You count the tiles in the ceiling. You count the different colors in the holy pictures, the stained glass. Did Jesus, you do anything to get through that half hour. And one of the things that I found to be sort of interesting was the Italian women who were mourning the death of a loved one. Italian women have to be the greatest mourners in the world. It seemed like in those days when somebody would die, everything turned black right away. Black veil, black hat, black fur, black socks, before they were even in vogue, you know. And the Italian women used to come into the mass at 8 o'clock in the morning. And they always went down them side aisles. And I wasn't allowed to go down them side aisles because I hadn't received my first Holy Communion yet. So the side aisles were sort of a mystery. And we weren't allowed to turn around and gawk at the nuns and hit you, you know. So you just kneel there, you know, but you can hear them coming down. Then they disappear into the corner of the church. And you couldn't see them, but I used to wonder, what the hell is going on? And I had lots of 8-year-old thoughts. I used to look around at all the statues. I used to wonder why my mother prayed to statues. Why my mother said, God has the answer. And I'd look up there and I'd say, a goddamn statue. What the hell does she mean he's got there? God will take care of you. How the hell is he going to get down off of there? These are innocent 8-year-old thoughts. And then, down in there. Never did I realize how important that discovery was going to be to me in my later years. Because I noticed something. When the Italian women would leave that corner, they wouldn't leave by them side aisles. They'd come to the center of the church, they'd genuflect, and they'd turn around, and they'd leave right up the center. And they'd come right past me. I'd be like that, you know, looking at them. And I noticed something. I didn't know what went on in the corner of that church. But whatever the hell went on caused them people to look different when they came from that corner. They weren't crying anymore. They weren't mumbling. And they seemed to be at peace with themselves. Something happened in the corner. And I just let that thought go. And so years later, he's dead, pounding on me, you know, beating on me. You gotta believe in God. Don't give me that crap, God, you know. And he's harping and harping and just wouldn't let go, you know. And he says, come on, there's gotta be a time in your life when you called upon God. I said, no, none of that crap for me, you know. Man, he's pounding. And then I made him sick. I said, look, Ned, why don't you leave me alone? I said, the closest anything has ever been like that was only a coincidence. And you should never say that word around an old-timer. Never say coincidence. And he just looked at me with them eyes, and he said, tell me about the coincidence. Well, the coincidence happened when I was 8 years old. My older brother Jack came down very ill. And this was in the days prior to antibiotics, and he had double pneumonia and streptococcus, and he was very, very sick. And we were a poor ghetto-type family, and so there was no hospitalization for my brother. Common customs in those days with the city would furnish you a hospital bed, and you'd set it up in your parlor. And a visiting nurse would come around two or three, four times a week, I don't really know how many times, and a doctor would come by occasionally and tend my brother. My brother lay out there in that parlor for an awful long, long time, you know, ill. But I was so young, you know, I wish I could say it really made me emotionally upset, but it didn't. And then one night I heard my mother being talked to by the doctor, and the doctor told my mother that my brother was about to die that evening, that his lungs were filling up rapidly with water and he would soon drown, and if he didn't die that night, he certainly would be dead the next day. And again, that's, you know, I just went to bed. I got up in the morning and Mother fixed whatever we used to have for breakfast and off I went to school. I didn't look in on my brother or ask about my brother. I just too young to realize the finality of death, I guess. And off I went to school, and on the way to school I did what I always did. I stole some pennies off of one of the newsstands so I could get candy, and I had these 5 pennies in my pocket. And I went through the school day, went through the nuns and all of that crap, and got out at 3:15, and I'm standing down there in the corner waiting for Mr. Schaefer, the cop, to pull me across the street so I go on down the hill and go on home. And then all of a sudden, you know, it dawned on me. My brother is probably dead. And I began to panic, and I envisioned my brother in a hole with people throwing dirt on him. And I just collapsed almost. And I turned around and I realized I was standing in front of the church. And I thought about the Italian women. And I thought about the corner of that church. And what the hell happened in the corner of that church? So I went in the church, and only those of you who have been educated in the parochial system will know the courage it took for me to walk down them side aisles. Because the word was out, if you got caught in them side aisle, you'd grow horns or get hair on your hand. No, that was something else. But it was just something you didn't do, you know. And I looked around the church, and there was no priest in there, no nuns in there. And I went down that side aisle. And I got down to the railing, and I was totally disappointed. Just another bunch of statues. More statues. Well, I guess in my educational process, I'd just been programmed that when you approach the railing, you automatically kneel. So I automatically just knelt. Now, I'd be a liar. I told you I could remember what went on that morning. I don't. I don't remember. But I'm quite sure of some things. I prayed, which is nothing more than talking, to somebody or something that afternoon. I don't know if it was a statue or what it was. And the other thing that I'm sure of, that when I prayed, I didn't pray any of them little prayers that them nuns had made me memorize and that a thousand other kids could rattle them off just like that with no meaning at all. Now, knowing me, I probably cried like hell. And I talked about my brother, because I didn't want my brother to die. And when I got finished, I fingered them 5 pennies in my pocket, because right alongside of me was a big brass thing filled with candles. Half of them were lit and half of them weren't. And it said, offering, 10 cents. I guess I figure I'm a kid, you know, I get half price. And I put them 5 precious pennies in that tube. And I lit every candle that wasn't lit. And then I left. My brother Jack visits me every summer from New York. He's retired secretary treasurer of the International Longshoremen's Union in New York City and had an honorable career. Honorable career. And a wonderful life. Married his high school sweetheart, raised a beautiful family. Obviously he lived, you know. But I wouldn't be so egotistical to think that my brother is alive because of my prayers. I'm quite sure my mother, with a lot more sincerity and a lot more often, prayed for my brother, along with our sisters, my aunts and uncles, and a lot of other people. And I told that to Ned. I said, see, Ned, it was just a coincidence. You know, the doctor was wrong. Can't you accept that? Never mind his AA crap. And he says, come on now. He says, you got the gate open. Think. He says, there was another time. And I said, no, there was no other time. Never again. I said, I shouldn't have even told you that. I said, the very next thing you want me to be telling you about that time. He says, what's home? And it was in that same school. Probably the worst day of my life. Came that day when you used to leave the 8th grade and go on into the public high school system. Graduation day. And we're all sitting in the classroom and the nuns come down and they're handing everybody their report cards and the kids are smiling and happy. And they gave me an envelope addressed to my father. I can't remember it word for word, but it said something like this. Dear Mr. Duffy, this is to inform you that it's the decision of the faculty of Our Lady of Victory Church that in your son's best educational interests, he be held for one more year at the 8th grade level due to his inability to absorb the lessons in the English language. Now, my father wouldn't have read it that way. My father would have picked it up and it would have said, Dear Mr. Duffy, because you are a dumb son of a bitch. Your son is a dumb son of a bitch. And he would have killed me. He would have killed me. And I was full of fear. Oh, I remember entertaining thoughts, wondering what the age limit was for the Foreign Legion. And is it really true if you dig deep enough you can come up in China? Man, I won't do anything except face my father. My mother had given me a nickel to take the streetcar home because I'm carrying all them goodies home from the last day of school, you know. One sneaker, busted jock shorts, and half-finished bookcase from the wood shop, and 6 busted loose-leaf binders, you know. All them goodies, you know. And I'm holding it all, and I'm standing on the corner waiting for Mr. Schaefer to let me across. I go on down the hill and get on a streetcar and go home. Boy, and I'm thinking about my father. He's going to kill me. And I'm crying. And then I realized again I was standing in front of the church. And I remembered my brother. And I remembered the Italian women. I remembered that corner. So I walked into the church and I put myself stuck down in the vestibule. By this time I had received communion, so I went right down the side. Right up to that same little bunch of statues, got down at that same railing. And again, I don't know who the hell I talked to. But I talked to somebody and told him how embarrassed I was of being so dumb and how smart. And, you know, and I cried, got finished, and I took out my mother's nickel and I put it in that thing. And again, I lit all the candles that were in it. And I went on down the hill, lied to the streetcar conductor, told him I dropped my nickel down the sewer, and he let me on the streetcar. And I don't know if it was all the seats were taken or what, whatever possessed me to sit down, but I sat down and had to share a seat with a guy that was already in it. Great big guy, got about 6'6", big, big man, you know, about 24 years old. And we trundled along for a few stops, and then all of a sudden this guy says to me, "You just getting out of school for the summer?" I said, "That's right." He said, "Boy, I bet you're happy." And man, that was like pulling your finger right out of the dike, you know. Boom, I just let it out. And I told that guy how scared I was and how ashamed I was. And I just told him the whole story. And he just sat there and he listened to me and listened to me. And when I had all finished, you know, he said, "Well, hasn't anybody told you about an opportunity called summer school?" Then he explained that I could go to summer school, he thought, for 8 weeks. And I couldn't understand how I could pass something in 8 weeks that obviously I couldn't pass in 18. And he said, "Well, you'll have to do things different, you know." He said, "You'll have to leave the baseball cards home." He said, "You'll have to stop talking in the class, stop looking out the window." And he says, "When the teacher gives you a lesson to take home at night, you take it home and do it." And I listened to this guy, you know, because he seemed to be oozing with compassion. So I said, "Do you really think I could do that?" And he sort of smiled and he says, "Yeah," he says, "if you do what I told you to do there, I'm pretty sure you'd pass." The man that sat alongside of me that day, his name is Hamilton B. Ryder. About 8 years ago, he retired as the superintendent of schools in Mount Vernon, New York. But the day that he sat there in that streetcar with me, he was a young student teacher assigned his first professional job in the teaching business to teach English in the summer school session. He's been a very important man in my life, a very important man in my life, all throughout my life, through my wartime experiences and other things like that. He was a pillar of strength for me, always. And so there I was my coincidences again. And of course now Ned had me because he just kept flying them at me, and the more I saw it, the more I discovered. The more I discovered. And you know, that's what we urge you to do in this program. You know, the answer is in the book. It is there, God could and would. And it's the seeking that our egotistical, self-centered nature doesn't allow us to do, because maybe we're afraid we're going to find somebody that can do something better than we could. And we're even warned and told about that in the 12 promises, where it says, "Soon you will discover that God is doing for you what you could not do for yourself." And every one of us in this room, try to sober up, try to straighten up your life, clean up your act before you came to AA, and you failed. And now you sit here with some semblance of dignity back in your life. The sobriety has been accomplished. Do you think you did that? Do you really think you did that? God is doing for you what you could not do for yourself. So here I am now, sort of believing in God. But then I work with a lot of people who still won't believe that. And you know, I'm a cocky little bastard, you know. After a while, you outlive your critics and your credentials are good enough that you can get cocky, I guess. And I don't really mean to be cocky, you know. It's just the love that I have for this program today. But I always want to prove things to you. And I can prove to you not only the existence of God, but I can prove to you the existence of the power of God. Example 1. Please, by a show of your hands, How many of you in this room are fathers? All right. Are you going to try to tell me that you never talked to God? In case you have forgotten, I'll tell you an exact time when you talked to God. Now you pause for a minute and reflect back on that day or that night, wherever the hell you were. And maybe now they have just taken the most precious thing in your life, your wife. They just wheeled her off into, what do they call it? That labor room, where she is about to experience the most excruciating pain known to anybody who's ever walked the face of this earth. A pain that no man will ever know. And she will experience that pain to present you with a child. And let me tell you what you were saying out there in the hall. You were saying things like this: "Hey, God, I don't really give a shit if it's a boy or a girl, that guy. I just want a normal kid, God. I don't want nothing special. Just have regular arms, God. Regular. Nothing. Just, oh, God, don't let nothing happen to them." And if you dare tell me or anybody else in this room that you never said that, you have never been a father. And then in this room right now are assembled at least veterans of four of our country's wars. Vietnam, Desert Storm perhaps, Korea. Again, are you going to tell me you didn't talk to God? In our war there was a cliche that said, "There are no atheists in foxholes." And if you say you never talked to God, you never went to war, you never went to war. So it's like they said in this book, you search for this evidence because it abounds in your life over and over and over again. So I finally then began to believe in God. But the statues were still there. The statues were still there. And I'm trying to think a Catholic God. And then one night I heard somebody say, "As you understand him." Not as Sister Ignatia understood him. Not as Sister Mary understood him. Or Father Kelly. Oh, Brother Timothy, how do you understand him? And so I began to be aware to find some kind of understanding. And often you hear in AA, keep coming to these meetings, and pretty soon you're going to hear what you have to hear. I don't know how many meetings I've been to Alcoholics Anonymous, 8,000, I guess, in 41 years. I ain't been there when they've closed the meeting all the time. I always stay till the end. They've been closing them the same with the exception of holding your hand, which is recent. It's always, "Let's close this meeting in the usual manner with a large prayer." And like everybody else, I'm up. Big race to see who gets through quickest, you know. Just like it was in the parochial school. And then one day, "Let's close this meeting in the usual manner with the Lord's Prayer." And I stood up and I said, "Our Father." And I knew, as I understood him. Please, with your permission, I want to tell you about my father. I loved my father more than anything I have ever loved in my life. My father was the greatest thing in my life. The greatest thing. In the eyes of the district attorney of the state of New York, by the name of Thomas Dewey, my father and a lot of other guys were criminals. And they had to pay a hell of a price for that. But for anybody I've ever talked to, my father and his friends were more Robin Hoods than they ever were criminals. But the law was the law. My father was a big guy. He was about 6'4", come in at about 240. And every inch of him was a man. And my father loved life. Jesus, that he loved life. He used to drive my mother crazy, you know. My mother was a very frugal Irish immigrant lady. And my father was a very gregarious guy, gambler. One day rich, next day poor, and he didn't give a shit. And he used to say to my mother, in that Cary Grant sort of way, my mother's name was Julia, and he'd say, "Julie, Julie, Julie, don't worry about money so much. Money can do nothing but cause trouble. The secret is to get rid of it as quick as you can." And she'd get pissed at me. Oh, she'd hit him with a shoe, and she was only about that big. And I never got to see my father so much due to the nature of his activities. And they used to run a lot of boats down from Canada and up from Puerto Rico and other places like that. And they were involved in gambling, a lot of gambling. In those days, you know, they could refer to them as the Roaring Twenties. The three major criminal factions in the East Coast or in New York City were the Irish gangs, the Italian gangs, and the Jewish gangs. And of course, my father was in the Irish gangs, very, very much into the Irish gangs. And so there was a lot of violence, and it was true. But I never saw none of that. And I knew of it, you know, kids on the street would tell me. I could see it in newspapers, and different school teachers thought it was something big to know the son of somebody, you know, and shit like that. And all I could remember about my father was how gentle he was and how smart he was. Because when he would be home, it usually would be a Sunday. And my father never went to church. His church was the Elks Club. And he used to take me with him to the Elks Club every Sunday morning. I was the baby in our family, so naturally I'm my father's favorite. And I can remember that right to this very second. Walking right through Little Italy. Holding out to my father's hand. Big hand, like King Kong, you know. And my father wore a derby. He never wore a tie or the plastic collar. He always wore striped shirts and a vest. And the big black hair used to come out of here. Big, like steel wool, you know. And in moments of affection, he pushed me to him, you know, and it felt like it scratched my face, you know. And my father knew all the answers. He knew why the sky was blue. He knew why grass was green. Anything I asked him, he had the answer to. I realize now they were probably all bullshit, but you know. But I didn't know it then. And Jesus, was he a dreamer? Was he? Oh, I tell you, you would have loved my father. My father would have loved you. He would have loved you. He used to take me for walks down on Riverside Drive up or down the Hudson River, you know. And I can remember one day we were looking out there at the Hudson River, and he says, "Next Saturday is your birthday." He says, "I think I'll do something different for your birthday this year." And I said, "What are you going to do, Dad?" He said, "We got to make it special." He said, "I think I'll bring the entire Atlantic fleet into the Hudson River." I said, "For Christ's sake, Dad, don't talk that kind of shit." He says, "No, you deserve something big." And I'll be goddamn. We're down there the next Saturday, and there's battleships and cruisers and destroyers all over the place. I'm not that my natal birthday coincides with Navy Day, you know. But that's how he was. That's how he was. And everybody knew my father. And it seemed like everybody loved him, you know. We'd go past the bakery and the guy'd give me a bag of cookies. We'd go past the produce guy and I'd get a bag of plums, and people in the roofs would holler at him. And he was always giving people money. And he didn't laugh, he roared. God, you could hear him for blocks away, you know. And he'd hold my hand. And the gentleness. how vivid this memory is of my father. We lived in a cold water flat, tenement houses they called them then, and my brother Jack raised pigeons up on the roof. And one hot summer night, and this is long before air conditioning, and the way you cooled off in New York City in those days was you stripped down to your underwear, and you sat out on the stoop or the porch, and the fire department would come by and open up the fire hydrants, and the little kids could run through the water, and the men would sit out there and drinking pails of beer, you know, and trying to just get cool. And whenever I could, I always sat alongside of my father because of this deep affection I had for him, you know. I just wanted to be close to him all the time. And then this one particular night, my brother Jack came down from the roof crying his head off. Man, he was crying. And he had his favorite pigeon in his hands. And the pigeon had somehow gotten its wing caught in the chicken wire up in the chicken coop. And he just couldn't lift himself off the ground. He just kept hobbling around like that. And my brother is, oh, really, carry on. And my father says, give me the pigeon, you know. And he put out his hand. I can see it right now. Big hand. And my brother Jack put that pigeon in there, you know. And the pigeon started going, mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, any minute my father's going to go like that. Just thrust that. And he started fooling around with little threads coming from his BVDs. And he had a match, and he screwed around here, and like that, and he licked stuff like that. And he put the pigeon down and threw away. He fixed the goddamn pigeon. And that's what I remembered about him. I don't remember the violence. I know of the violence, but it's not a memory. What I'm trying to tell you is that my father is not God. But it's how I understand God. You see, like with my father, if I can walk on a daily basis with my hand in the hand of God, nobody's going to harm me. I'm perfectly safe as long as I hold on to this God. And I'm probably the luckiest guy or person in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I get to talk to my dad every morning and every night and a lot of other times too when I need to talk to somebody. And I talk to him just like I would talk to my father, and I'm talking to God as I understand him. And like my father, God has always answered me. And I know it's not bullshit with God. I know that. And I know as long as I maintain this relationship, this belief in this power, that I can walk any place. I can walk any place. And that with the help of God, as I understand him, and the power of this program, I am free. Free at last from what the book says, that bondage. How fortunate I am. How fortunate I am. Now, I could understand you saying, well, that's a theatrical bunch of bullshit that he's putting out. Because I probably would have said that too at one time. But personally, I don't give a goddamn what the hell you think, you know? Because it's God as I understand him, not as we understand him. And again, I'm not so naive that I don't know that some of you in this room are still full of denial, that you're still sitting there wanting to be challenged, egotistical enough to want to demand proof. Well, I'm going to prove it to you. How about that from a fat, bald-headed, blood-selling, uneducated wino? I got the audacity to tell you that I can prove to you not only the existence of God, but the existence of that power. Of course, I need a little bit of action on your part. Not much, so don't get excited. I want you to go tonight when you get home, when you retire, whether you believe it or not, make some attempt at prayer. You don't have to do all of that fancy. You don't have to get down on your knees and do all of this. But you're just going to be talking. That's all you're going to be doing. Oh, and if some of you happen to be in situations where you're going to share a room with somebody else, and you don't want to display this obvious sign of weakness by praying, do like we did in the penitentiary. Put the blanket over your head and they'll think you're masturbating. And then say this. Here's all I ask you to say. None of those boo things. Something like this. You say, God, make tomorrow, which will be Monday, a better day for... Then you put the name of anybody you want in there. Preferably somebody you're going to be able to see or be in contact with. In other words, something simple like, God, make tomorrow a better day for Jack. And then go to sleep. And when you wake up Monday morning, don't you tell anybody who you prayed for tonight. You just keep that between you and God. And then I challenge you to observe what takes place tomorrow in the life of the person that you pray for tonight. I challenge you to do that. Now, why can I be so cocky about that? Why can I appear to be so damn sure about that? It's easier for me than it is for you because I can see all of you. Is there anyone in this room right now so full of denial, so sick, that you can't accept the fact that you sit out here right now with some semblance of dignity back in your life as a direct result of someone else's prayers? Your mother's? Your child's? Is every little kid that'll go to his knees tonight before a crib, are they wrong and you're right? Are all those who pray silly? Is that a waste of time? Or is it real? Or is it real? And then if you sit here wondering, well, will God do anything for me? Scumhead like me? Because that's what I thought. Because, you know, my drinking career wasn't too pretty. I've stole from churches, robbed graves, and I'm not proud of any of that. But it was all part of getting here. And I, for a long time, had a fear that if God knew I walked amongst you, you who are so pure and nice, and he'd certainly do something about that, because God undoubtedly had to hate me. Then I recall something that I want to share with you in closing. It's a little tale about a sharecropping family that lived in Georgia. Now, I don't know how many of you have ever been in Georgia. But trying to make a living out of the soil in Georgia is almost impossible. Georgia is nothing but red clay. Horrible! And yet this little, close-knit family scraped year in and year out to survive. And that's all they did. They enjoyed none of the luxuries that you and I seem to take for granted. Each year they would make just enough money to pay the bills and to buy the seed for the next year so they could go on again. That's how it was, year in and year out. And then one year, after all the bills were paid and the seed was purchased, they had $5 left over. It was the first time that they had ever had any money to spend on themselves. And they were extremely joyous about this. But they were wise. They realized that $5 couldn't buy each member of the family a gift. So they decided to buy one gift that the entire family could share. So after some kind of discussion, they decided to buy a mirror. This family had never owned a mirror. No one in that family had ever seen his or her own true self. They all knew the beauty in each other, but no one had ever been exposed to his own true image. So it was a very exciting day, the day the mirror arrived, and they gathered in the kitchen, and out of respect for the father, they let him be the first to look into the mirror. Now, he knew the beauty of his wife and of his daughter and his little son. And when he looked into the mirror and saw himself for the first time, he did exactly what elderly, mature men would do. He blushed a little bit, you know, and he fixed his glasses, and he tugged on his overall strap and backed his nose a couple of shots. And he just smiled, and he handed the mirror to his wife, who knew the beauty of her husband and of her children. And she, too, did what mature women would do. She blushed and fooled with the collar on her house coat and giggled a little bit, and, you know, and then turned and handed the mirror to her teenage daughter, who was a beautiful girl, and did exactly what teenage girls would do. She giggled a little bit and fooled with the curls in her hair and the ribbon in her hair and tee-hee-heed a little bit, you know, and because she knew the beauty of her family. And then she turned and handed the mirror to her little 7-year-old brother, who knew all of the beauty of his parents and of his sister. But when her little brother had only been 1 year old, he had been standing alongside of his daddy while his daddy was milking a cow. The cow had kicked out and struck this little boy in the face. And what was supposed to have been a little child's face was nothing but a twisted, ugly, grotesque mask of flesh. It was horrible. When that little child looked into the mirror and saw what was supposed to have been his face, he was totally confused. And as a little child, he went immediately to his mother. And he said, "Mama, have I always been this ugly?" And she said, "No, you haven't always been this ugly." And he said, "But Mama, what I don't understand is, how can you love me when I'm so ugly?" And she said what every mother would say, "Because you're mine." And that's the relationship that I have now with a loving God as I understand Him. For it's only He who has known me in my total ugliness. When my family, with just cause, had to turn away from me because of my ugliness. When my friends also with just cause had to turn away, I stood just like you. I stood there looking and waiting for that answer. And then one morning, just as it was done here this morning, I heard it. No human power will relieve your alcoholism, but God could and would if He was sorry. So I sought this God, and I sought this God as I was directed to seek this God through prayer and through meditation. And somewhere out there, this God heard my supplication. And then He took me, a scum like me, and He brought me to people like you. And from your midst, He selected one to be the instrument to carry the recovery to me. And for that, I am eternally grateful. God bless you, and thank you for having me here.